The fourth aliyah of Parshas Mishpatim begins with the words Elohim lo sekalel v'nasi v'amcha lo sa'or, and it is a machlokes in the Mechilta and in the Gemara in Sanhedrin whether that first word is kodesh or chol, whether it's a reference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu or to Dayanim who are represented by that word as well. And the Rambam and the Ramban write, practically speaking, that it includes both. If it is a reference to cursing Dayanim, then the question comes up, why specifically are they identified here? One shouldn't curse anyone, as we know from elsewhere in the Torah. And there are some who explain that this is simply a way of identifying the most likely candidate to be cursed, somebody who people are likely to have a complaint against because of their involvement in litigation. Others suggest that this represents Hashem's authority and represents the system as a whole. And one who curses a Dayan will come to disrespect the entire system. And that's perhaps related also to what we find in the end of the Pasuk, V'nasi v'amcha lo sa'or. Most of the Rishonim understand that this is a reference to a king. The Rambam includes here also the Nasi of the Sanhedrin. So why specifically is there a prohibition to curse the king? So the Sfarno understands that what is bad for the king is bad for the country as a whole, a point that we often forget when arguing about politics and politicians, that the fate of the nation is tied up in the fate of the leader. And the Sefer Achinuch understands a similarly relevant point, that people will always disagree about aspects of leadership, but there's always going to be a need to pick a leader and to understand that no one's going to be completely happy, and therefore that recognition requires us to accept the reality and not to curse out the choices that we have as leaders. The next pasuk contains the words lo sa'acher, followed by b'chor banecha titainli, which sounds like this is a obligation regarding pidyon haben, not to delay. And the Baal HaTorah understands that the obligation is right after the 30th day, the Magen Avraham, assuming that there is a prohibition of Baal Ta'acher not to delay the mitzvah anywhere beyond that. The Rashash, in his commentary to Menachos on Daf Samach Vav, understands differently, that there isn't actually a prohibition to delay a pidyon haben, but it's simply a negation of the notion of Zrizin Magdalene. That's also the implication of the Shulchan Aruch in Yoridei and Simin Shin Hei. There are others who treat it more stringently. The Levush sounds like there is indeed an Isser, and the Kolbo goes so far as to say that one who would delay Pidyon HaBen would have to add a Chomesh as a penalty, would have to add on 25%. There are those who suggest that perhaps there is a Isser to leave a baby in an unredeemed state. Practice, we assume that there is a bittul of zrizin and a simple delay of a mitzvah in not fulfilling the mitzvah of pidyon haben at the proper time. Perek Chav Gimel begins with the words lo sisa shema shav. The Gemara in Masechus Pesachim, Kuf Yud Ches Amud Aleph, identifies this pasuk as a source for the prohibition of Kabbalas Lashon Hara. And there's a major discussion how to understand the pasuk in that context and also how to understand the prohibition. One way to understand shav is to read it as pointless and unnecessary, and therefore the pasuk could be translated as do not accept a report that is presumably negative and also unnecessary, which would be consistent with the idea that there is a prohibition both to speak and to receive Lashon Hara when it has no purpose, but when there is a toelis, when there is a need, for example, to protect those who are vulnerable, so then there is an obligation both to speak and to receive the Lashon Hara, at least to the extent that it is necessary to prevent the harm. And therefore, that language would help us to understand this notion of toelis. However, it's noteworthy that both Rashi and Unkelus understand the word shav here as sheker, therefore rendering it do not receive a false report, and that requires some explanation if we assume that the prohibition of Lashon Hara is specifically including something which is true, so therefore the idea that the pasuk, which tells us that we're not allowed to accept it, is translated as do not accept a false report. And this is a question that's raised by the Sefer Aksava HaKabbalah and others, and what seems to be indicated here is an important principle in understanding the nature of the Isser of Lashon Hara, that even if the speaker thinks that he's saying the truth, there are so many reasons why the picture that's being painted is not actually true, whether the speaker may be incorrect or incomplete or subjective or functioning under various cognitive biases that make us think that we may be telling the truth, but really we are fundamentally lacking in accuracy. And therefore, even if the speaker believes he's saying the truth, very often what reaches the ears of the listener is something false. And therefore, perhaps that's why the pasuk is telling us, focusing on the receiving of the Lashon Hara, that one should not receive falsehood. Rabbeinu Yonah adds a word to the explanation, pointing out that one doesn't need to be told not to accept that which is false if he knows that it's false, and therefore we should understand the meaning to be, don't accept as true that which may not be true. In other words, obligating us to be careful and understand that even if we think something is credible, it may not necessarily be the truth or the full truth, and therefore we're obligated to preserve that skepticism and to understand that we may be hearing something which is indeed false. Yiznayim Torah does suggest, though, that maybe even when one does know that something is completely false, we still need to be told not to listen to it, because we may believe that it's harmless if we know that it's false, but this still encourages the speaker to engage in such slander, and therefore, even when we know it's false, we need a prohibition to be involved. But that raises the question of whether the prohibition is actually to listen or something more than that. Most assume that the prohibition isn't simply to listen. The Chafetz Chaim understands the prohibition to be to believe the Lashon Hara and to accept it as true. And even in the case of Toeles, when it's purposeful, the Lashon Hara is only to be taken as a warning that one should be choshish to, one should factor in the possibility, but still in the Chafetz Chaim's understanding should not believe it to be true. That's the way he interprets the language of the Gemara and Maseches Nida. Others, such as Rav Moshe Starbuch, disagree and assume that we don't actually have control over what we believe. That's something that happens automatically. But the prohibition of Kabbalah's Lashon Hara means that we shouldn't act on it if it's not necessary for protection, and we shouldn't treat the person any differently because of what we heard. Presumably, there is also space in the middle, the Chafetz Chaim recognizing that believing is often an automatic process, but also recognizing that there is a lot we can do in order to control how we process information, as Rabbeinu Yonah was indicating, and to recognize the possibility that what we're hearing isn't necessarily the full truth. In either interpretation, we find that it's either about believing it or acting on it, but not simply on listening. However, the Chafetz Chaim suggests that perhaps there is a prohibition of listening in even of itself, because there is another Isser that is derived from these same words. The Gemara in the Maseches Sanhedrin on Daf Zayin Amud Beis understands this to apply to a prohibition to a dayan from listening to one side not in the presence of the other. And in that situation, the Isser is simply on the act of listening, and therefore, if they're all from the same words, maybe we should understand that regarding Kabbalah's Lashon Hara, the prohibition is also simply to listen. However, others point out that there is a distinction when it comes to a dayan, so then he has to remain completely objective, and to allow one litigant to speak not in the presence of the other is automatically going to distort his objectivity, which is not necessarily true for someone who's not in a dayan position. It's also true regarding the possibility of sheker, using that interpretation of the word shav, that when a dayan is dealing with litigants, if he allows one to speak when the other is not present, so that is more likely to bring about sheker, and perhaps that's related. So therefore, it's possible that these issues are relevant specifically to a dayan and not to the average person, and therefore the prohibition of listening simply without going any further may be relevant only to the dayan and not to the general prohibition of Kabbalah's Lashon Hara. The Chafetz Chaim does also note, though, that it sounds like from the Gemara Maseches Ksubis that there may be at least be a rabbinic prohibition involved in even just listening to Lashon Hara, but this is also dependent on the assumption that what's being said doesn't have the possibility of being purposeful or necessary for protection, in which case there would be a requirement to at least listen in order to know if that's the case. It's also noteworthy that there is a specific prohibition for Kabbalah's Lashon Hara by itself, and we aren't expected to understand that already from the notion of lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, that we shouldn't enable or encourage a transgression. And this tells us that apparently the act of absorbing the lashon hara, whether it means in behavior or in belief, is itself its own prohibition. And it's even more striking that according to a position in the Gemara there in Psachim, this is the source of the prohibition not only of receiving lashon hara but even of speaking lashon hara, which has many other candidates, but this seems to be one of them as well. And if that's the case, perhaps it shows us that the prohibition of Kabbalah's Lashon Hara is not only its own idea, more than just being an accessory, but may even be the main idea, and that the prohibition of receiving Lashon Hara isn't that you are facilitating Lashon Hara, but that's really where the main offense happens, in the forming of an unfair and unjustified opinion of someone else. In which case, it's understandable that the Isser is presented as focusing on the Mekabel, and maybe the speaker is actually the one facilitating the core offense here. And it's noteworthy that the Rambam in Hilchos Deos, when he records the statement of the Gemara in Erechin, that the crime of Lashon Hara hurts both the subject and the speaker and the recipient, he adds words there, v'hamekabel yoser min ha'omro, that the one who is the mekabel, the recipient, is in even worse position than the speaker, which is a very striking idea. But if we focus specifically on the formation of the unfair view about the subject, maybe that can be understood. And if we go back to our idea that the nature of the Isser Lashon Hara has to do with the fact that it may seem like the truth, but actually is painting an unfair picture of the subject, so that could be said to be even more true about the recipient. The speaker may not realize how much what he's saying is lacking in accuracy or fairness, and that's one reason for a prohibition, but the one who is hearing it is even less aware and less attentive to the nuances, and is getting an even more distorted picture, something that psychologists have identified as the teller listener extremity effect, meaning that whatever deficiencies are in the speech are even more so in terms of the processing of the listener. And perhaps in that sense, we can understand the Rambam's emphasis that the Mekabel is in even worse position than the one speaking. We also find in this Aliyah the concept of Rov in the context of the Beis Din, Achrei Rabim Lahatos. There is a fascinating halacha that tells us that even though we are obligated to follow the majority in matters of judicial decisions, including in dinei nefashos, however, a Beis Din shero ku l'chov, the Beis Din sees only guilt in the sense that they are unanimous, there actually is an exemption of the person under trial. It's quite a surprising halacha. It's a question why that should be. It sounds perhaps from the Gemara that there isn't a possibility of acquitting him based on the back and forth, and for that reason he can't be convicted. Some understand that anything that is so black and white, that doesn't have any opposing side, there must be something missing. The Torah Tamima has a long discussion about this where he finds that to be an inadequate explanation. There are indeed some things that are pretty straightforward, and we can't argue that they're false specifically because nobody disagrees, and perhaps in fact there was a lot of back and forth, and still everyone ended up with a unanimous conclusion. He therefore leans towards the interpretation that the Meiri quotes from the Rama and that others quote, that actually it doesn't mean what it sounds like, and rather the language of Gemara of potrin oso miyad means we immediately take him to be executed without waiting any further in order to consider the possibility that he might find some exoneration. My grandfather, in his commentary, Meshivas Nefesh, the Torah Tamima, notes that it's not clear from the language of the Ramah that that's actually what he meant either. It could be that he also meant that there is no point in delaying the process because there isn't going to be the possibility of exoneration, and therefore, indeed, he has to be let go. One way or another, this is a very striking concept which impressed the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia to say this is a uniquely Jewish concept. And it was also a subject of a comment here from the Orach Chaim, who suggests that the language of the pasuk here in telling us a prohibition is referring to a dayan who might think, okay, I believe this individual is guilty, but all my colleagues also believe he's guilty, so therefore if I vote guilty, it'll be unanimous and he'll be exonerated. So therefore, perhaps I should change my vote to say innocent, even though I believe he's guilty, in order to bring about the result that I want, that he should indeed be convicted. And the Torah is telling us that there's a prohibition here, that even if you think you're going to bring about a just result through saying something that's not actually what you believe, that's not the nature of the process. The process is that the dayan has to vote what he thinks is true and let it come out however it comes out in terms of the final psak. That itself is the process that will bring about justice according to the Torah. In a more basic sense, that may also be the intention of the pasuk here, as some point out, that telling us that the bottom line is going to be the result of a majority vote, but every dayan has to say what he actually thinks, and he shouldn't allow himself to be convinced by the fact that the majority are voting one way simply to skip the process of thinking about it and to submit his opinion to the majority, but rather he has to vote what he actually thinks, and then the process will be decided based on the majority of sincere opinions. All told, there are many fascinating dinim in this aliyah that contribute to our understanding of the relationship between truth and the judicial process, both officially in Bezdin and between individuals in everyday life.